Lecture 16. Dialects. Two tongues in one mouth.
The key word is diglossia. What is diglossia? Greek for two tongues, but that doesn't really help us. Diglossia is a term that linguists use to refer to something else about the way non-standard varieties are distributed in real life across the globe. And that is that often the standard and the non-standard dialect are in a structured relationship in society, and they're in a structured relationship in the mouths of the individual. So rattling around in the back of your head, you might think to yourself, is there such a person who only speaks Brooklynese, who's unfamiliar with what standard English is like? It's hard to imagine that person. And indeed, just as actually around the world, it's been said that most people are bilingual and that the monolingual state of the typical American is the exception, you could also say that most people are bidialectal. So the non-standard and the standard variety exist in the same mouth. So, diglossia, two tongues. So, we've seen already that it's not about that people speak a good way and a bad way. It's more that people speak two ways, whatever other people might think of the way they speak, and more to the point, whatever people themselves might think about the two different things that they speak. But an example of this would be the Arabic that we talked about. So, for example, in Egypt, it would be modern standard Arabic and Egyptian Arabic. In Germany, in a region where the local variety is very different from High German, Hochdeutsch, then we'd be talking about High German versus, for example, outside of Germany itself, Switzerland, Swiss German, which is extremely different from High German. The two languages coexist in German-speaking Switzerland. Or in Greece, there was Katharevousa versus the Demotiki, the more familiar kind of Greek. Now, what all of these things have in common is that one of the varieties is considered the high one, and the other one is considered the low one. And so the idea is that one of them is considered more formal, often considered better, and the other one is considered more meat and potatoes, more what you would use after you had smacked your child on the butt, or what you would use to date somebody or something like that. And so there's the high and the low. Now, I'm going to call them the H and the L to ease us out of that tendency to think that the vernacular one is somehow broken. But H stands for high and L stands for low. Typically, in a diglossia, you get a certain four commonalities. One of them is that the H variety is used in writing, and the L variety is used in casual speech. So, for example, people read the paper in H, and then they'll discuss it in L. Or speeches, formal ones at least, are given in H, maybe seasoned by a bit of L, but then casual conversations are conducted in L, at best seasoned by a bit of H. Then there's the acquisition issue, which is that the L version is learned on your mother's knee. That is your native language. That's what you speak with no effort at all. The H is learned at school. You learn that later. And so if you happen not to benefit from education for one reason or another, then you probably are not much for H. So L is learned at home. You could call it the real language. H is something which is pounded into you later. H is the salad fork. L is the spoon. Then there's the standardization issue, which is that H typically is given official rules by an academy or the academy, while the non-standard L's are generally described in a systematic way only by missionaries or linguists. And so in general, if you go to B. Dalton, you're not going to find formal treatments of most of these. That dates me, actually. B. Dalton really doesn't count anymore. So let's change that to, if you go to Barnes & Noble or Borders, you will not find those sorts of things. So, in general, the L variety is cherished by the linguist, the fan of the exotic, the missionary, but for people who are actually there living these two varieties, the H is the one that gets standardized, gets taught in school, is thought of as having rules. So, for example, in Germany right now, the Asterisk series, which originated in France but is particularly popular in Europe, about the little fighting Gaul who's bedeviled by the Romans and has a big stupid friend named Obelix. Those are not only in Hochdeutsch, but they've been translated into a great many local German varieties, the idea being to help stem what is seen as a threat to those local varieties existing. So there is Swiss German Asterisk, there is Asterisk in the German of Cologne, there is Asterisk in Schwäbisch in South Germany, there's Bavarian Asterisk. And I have been in German airports and watched people chuckling reading through these, clearly not used to seeing, say, Swiss German on the page. It's kind of, it's a new thing for them, because really this exists outside of writing for them. So, H is standardized, L is not. And this also tends to mean that H gets kind of frozen, and many different varieties of L end up developing because it's inherent to language to always change. And we'll talk later about how standard varieties are kind of like TV dinners, whereas non-standard varieties are moving along like real living things do. But that's later. So, finally, there is the prestige issue. And this is something that can make it hard as a linguist to study language in its full variety. Generally, H is considered the real language. And people who are fluent speakers of L tend to feel funny about the fact that they use it. Their self-conception often conditions them to suppose that they speak it less well than they do. And to the extent that they realize that they speak it, often in public, they'll disown it. If you try to record somebody speaking the L, then they're going to sprinkle it with a lot of H or have trouble not using H because that's what's used in formal contexts. And so, it can be difficult to even get a sense of what the systematicity of an L is because it's not something that you're accustomed to using with outsiders, with a microphone, when you're presenting yourself at your best. You think of it as a kind of a slumming that you do, and you very well may not be aware that you slum, quote unquote, linguistically as much as you do, because there's a sense that the L variety is not real. So, for example, there were riots in Greece in 1903 when they published a New Testament in Demotiki, which is the L, as opposed to the very formal and artificial katharevousa. The idea was, if we're talking about the word of religious figures, then we certainly must have it be in the high, artificial, inaccessible, difficult language, rather than this trash that we actually speak. So there was a problem. I remember when I was, actually it was the last day of college for me, and I was moving out of the dormitory, and there were two dark-skinned gentlemen who were having this very animated conversation, and I could get the words, but for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what they were saying. And I wasn't a linguist yet, and I didn't know anything about H and L or any of these things, but I just knew that I kept hearing television, after, cat, sunshine, but I couldn't understand what they were saying. It literally felt like what people say having a stroke feels like. And for a minute, I thought, am I sick? Because it was really hot. But I just kept standing there watching them, these two black men speaking in English that I couldn't get. And I finally asked them, so, what are you speaking? And they got these irritated looks on their faces. And it wasn't that I didn't time it right. I waited till there was a pause. But asking them what they were speaking was a delicate business because in their heads they were speaking English. Now, I know, almost 20 years later, that what they were speaking was very fluent Jamaican patois. They were Jamaicans, and they were speaking the Creole language of Jamaica. We'll learn later exactly what a Creole is. But suffice it to say that almost all the words they were using were English words, and a little bit of the grammar had some other influences, but it was a kind of English, more or less. Now, linguists have a tendency to exotify languages like Jamaican Patois, and our tendency is to say, it is a different language with a different system, and we write down the grammar. To a Jamaican, it's just a different kind of English, and one that people tend to feel a little funny about. It's one thing to use snippets of it in reggae music. It's another thing to speak it in public, to share it with outsiders. It's thought of as not a language. It's not usually written in. So for me, to walk up as the sort of uptight outsider and say, what are you speaking? Well, they can't say, well, we're speaking Moldovan. They're not going to say, well, we're speaking a dialect of Mongolian or something like that. To them, it's English, but deep down they think of it as bad English, but it's the English they learned growing up, and they speak it very well, and they also have a kind of affection for it, but which can't be shared with me because I'm an outsider. It was irritating. That was a classic example of, for them, the H is standard English, which they spoke fine, and then the L was Jamaican Patois. That was diglossia. You could think of it as just me in this odd situation in 1985 out on the steps when it was hot with people I didn't know. But scientifically, that was diglossia. I've learned since then. I've come through it. I've coped. So, when you look at things like this, you see big differences. Egyptian Arabic. So now, in Egyptian Arabic, is dilwati. In standard Arabic, the word is al-ana. This is completely different. Dilwati al-ana. If you're talking about a nose in standard Arabic, the word is anf. In Egyptian Arabic, it's manakhir. So, if you're in Egypt, when you're bouncing on your mother's knee, I presume all people have done that at some point, although I don't remember ever bouncing on my own mother's knee, but when you're doing that, then you are learning manakhir. You are learning dilwati. Those are your words. That's how you come into the world. Then gradually you realize there's this other thing that you see on TV, or that people make speeches in, or that the Quran seems to be written in, which is not just kind of different the way the King James version of English is for us, but is really a whole different thing. If you've learned manakhir for nose, and then you try to talk about your nose in a formal setting and it's anf, clearly you have a great deal of learning to do. Now, sometimes it's not that far. Many in standard Arabic is kathira. In Egyptian Arabic, it's kathir. Okay, there's a relationship, but it's quite different. So, an Egyptian might say, well, I learned Arabic in school. I once heard a Moroccan put it in that way. Because it's different enough that you really are acquiring a whole different system, not just kind of cleaning up and formalizing what you already learned the way we standard English speakers do. In German-speaking parts of Switzerland, to only speak Hochdeutsch is to be a foreigner. To be Swiss, you have to speak Swiss German. And Swiss German is as different from Hochdeutsch as roughly Portuguese is from Spanish. I consorted briefly with a Swiss German female some years ago, and she once wrote me an email in Swiss German. I read standard German with joy and very quickly. I was so flummoxed by the Swiss German that I had to write her back and say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know whether you're asking me whether I want to go out tonight or you're telling me that there are strange looking spots on my feet. You know, please rewrite. And that was in writing. And when I would hear her speak Swiss German on the phone, she might as well have been speaking Mongolian. I could get not a word except for the occasional hiccup. And that's because it's very different. And so, for example, in High German, drink is trinken. In Swiss German, it's sufe. Well, you just kind of have to know. High German, kein, means not one, no. And then in Swiss German, it's just ke. Well, that's going to throw you. And so it's quite different. So that's how diglossia works in terms of there being these two varieties. And, of course, wait, there's more. There is even triglossia. Now, triglossia is so massively complex that I'm not going to be able to talk about it without taking a drink of the tea that I'm holding. And so there's going to be a very brief pause. Savor it. Anyway, triglossia is, as you might guess, when you've got, instead of two, three levels of language. And this happens in some particularly hierarchical societies where these hierarchies are very formal and codified. So, for example, in Javanese, and I know this is going to seem counterintuitive, but Javanese is spoken in Java. So just remember that. I know that's a hard one to remember. Javanese is a language with this kind of triglossic usage. And so not only is there an H and an L, a high and a low, but there is a middle rung. So, for example, just ordinary sentences become quite different in these three levels of language that one must be able to manipulate to be a Javanese person who is neither a child nor desirous of leaving. So, for example, just rice and cassava now. Those words in that order. In High Javanese, rice and cassava now are sekul kalian kaspe samenika. Now, in Middle Javanese, it's sekul lan kaspe saniki. And so, kalian and just becomes lan, samenika now becomes saniki. Related, but shorter and different. Then, in Lower Javanese, instead of sekul kalian kaspe samenika up top, you have sega lan kaspe saiki. So, very different. The high version of Javanese and the low version of Javanese are practically different languages, and yet to make your way in Java, you have to be able to handle that kind of thing. And the closest equivalent to this in English is the difference that we don't think about that much between, say, dine and eat. So you do not dine at KFC. Dine is used in very formal situations. Children versus kids is another one. If you're talking about your kids, then chances are you are not in a very formal situation. Children is the formal word, then kids is the more informal word. Or if you think about it, what's a parcel? What is a parcel? Like, you know what a parcel is, but what's a parcel as opposed to something else? What is a parcel shaped like? You know, why do we have that word parcel? The reason that we have parcel is because it's a formal word for bag, which is seen as a slightly mundane word. So instead of place your bags upon the divan, it's place your parcels upon the divan. Parcel is kind of the H word. You would never use the word parcel with your mouth full. You would never use the word parcel in your own home. Parcel is something that you see in a bathroom stall at the airport. It's something that you see posted somewhere. It's in directions that you don't read. Parcel is an H word. So this sort of thing has something to do with speaking English. Even a word like return. Imagine asking somebody, so when will you be returning tonight? I didn't say that. When are you coming back? Now, we all know what return means, but that's not a word that you use casually. I don't walk around returning. I come back. Return is either a written word, or you might say that to the king, or you might say that to someone who you didn't know very well. You might even say it to someone to indicate that you were mad. So when will you be returning tonight? A little bit of irony. But really, return is not a word of casual speech. I would say the same thing of refreshing, although I've been called on this. Why in the world would you ever say, oh my, that was refreshing? No, you say, that was good. Or, yeah, that hit the spot. Just what the doctor ordered. Boy, that was good. Mm-mm. You do not hold up the can and say, my, that was refreshing. That's a word that's used either on Madison Avenue or in books. Now, I've had people say that that's not true, but it is true. Refreshing is an H word, and mm-mm good is the L version of that. So, there are these kinds of differences, but imagine if you had to deal with something like that with pretty much every word in the language. Then you get a sense of how diglossia with, say, Egyptian Arabic or any local Arabic or Javanese works. So that kind of thing is taken to a greater degree in some languages than others. Now, diglossia also extends to separate languages. As I've often said, there are about 6,000 languages in the world and only 200 and change countries. So that shows that multilingualism in nations must be a norm unless a whole bunch of the languages are kind of hanging off somewhere else, but that doesn't make sense. And the appearance otherwise is due to the fact that if you go through an almanac, or nowadays you're on the internet or what have you, and you look at the world's official languages, then actually only a quarter of the world's countries recognize two languages officially, and only four recognize three or more. So if you look at the almanac, then you see that India has Hindi, English, and 14 other languages, many of which most of us have never heard of. Then Singapore has Chinese, Malay, and Tamil, and English. And then Spain has Spanish, Catalan, and Basque. And then Luxembourg, which is basically the size of your bedroom, recognizes French, German, and then a German variety called Letzeburgisch. Those are the only three. So it seems as if there are fewer languages than there are. But in fact, underneath that radar screen are a great many others. So it's typical that those languages are not just sitting spread on the ground like a patchwork quilt. Rather, they tend to exist in diglossic or triglossic relationships. Generally, within the country, one or maybe two are on top, and then the other ones are in a diglossic or sometimes triglossic relationship with the king one or two, or queen one or two. So, for example, in Paraguay, the official language is Spanish. So if you went to the airport in Asunción, then you would hear Spanish. But then there is the language spoken by a great many of the indigenous population. That language is called Guarani. And Guarani is in an L relationship with Spanish. So people who speak Guarani do not expect to hear it much on the news. They fully expect that if they're going to take their part in wider life, then they're going to learn Spanish. Spanish is what you mostly get in school, especially the higher you go, etc., etc. So in Paraguay, Spanish is the H and Guarani is the L. And generally, when you have extensive bilingualism in a country, then having this diglossic relationship is almost inevitable. The idea of languages existing side by side, like the dolls in the Small World exhibit at Disney World, where people are holding hands and rocking back and forth, and they're diverse, and some people wear clogs, and some people are brown, and some people aren't, and it's all just different. That's not the way the world really works. Actually, generally, somebody is above and somebody is below. So, for example, in Quebec, before 1974, the H language was English, and the L language was French. And this was based on historical circumstances. In the 70s, there was a law enacted that made French the official language of Quebec, and French was required in the government and to be used on signs, the idea being to make French equal. That was a very interesting experiment, but it's been a very delicate and charged situation, and it was imposed rather than emerging by itself. So the situation where English was on top was one that would have gone on indefinitely. When you read about Montreal back in the day, often you get the sense that a person who only spoke English did not sense that there was any problem. Harry Houdini went to Montreal and he dared somebody to punch him in the stomach, and they punched him in the stomach before he was ready, and actually it ended up hastening his death, which happened very quickly after that. That happened in a Montreal where he was having no trouble with running into French waiters or anything like that. You would think that he had been in Vancouver reading about how it happened. That's old Montreal. Today, when you go to Montreal, you cannot help but notice that, gosh, there's another language here that it would be nice to know. I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I will say that, however, the fact remains that if you only know French in Montreal, I think you probably sense yourself at more of a disadvantage here and there than if you only know English. If you're an English speaker and you don't know any French, well, okay, the waitress speaks French, that's interesting. But the second that you make a mistake in trying to speak French, she speaks English and she's quite comfortable. And in general, you're not going to get shushed or frowned on for using your language. It's very hard to create a situation where there is no diglossia. And this varies in different parts of Quebec, but the principle is there. Now, on the other hand, while extensive bilingualism without diglossia is rare and difficult, there are situations where there is diglossia among an elite, even if most people are not bilingual. So, for example, in Anna Karenina, Very often, for effect or for privacy, the characters who are Russians will break into French, and it's good French. That was actually something that happened in Tsarist Russia, where the cultivated person was given good, strong training in French, and to not know any French was to be something of a barbarian among that class. Of course, the vast, vast majority of Russians were not running around speaking French, they were speaking Russian. But the Anna Karenina people were doing this. Even in America, you can see hints of it. Right now, I'm reading John O'Hara's runaway hit of 1949, A Rage to Live. It's poised awkwardly between potboiler and literature, which is kind of what I wanted this summer, or at least this week. And it's interesting. It's about the elite of what is supposed to be Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And every now and then, it's indicated that they speak French. Not as much as the Anna Karenina people, but the idea is that if you went to school, you picked up at least some. You can make your way in a conversation. I recommend A Rage to Live, by the way, actually. It's one of those books of its time, kind of like Forever Amber a little before it, and Peyton Place afterward, that, shall we say, pushes the envelope in what is now a quaint way. It's a lot of fun to read about the people doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Anyway, so as far as diglossia goes, this is a situation which is not only about people in other parts of the world eating fruit that we can't have imported and things like that. This time, I don't want to say that it's not only about us, that it's about other people. This one is not only about other people, it's about us. And so, for example, perfect example, remember Ebonics back in late 96, 97? The media chewed that up and spat it out. And I think that what most of the public learned was that there's this colorful slang used by a certain class of people, and there was a school board that wanted to teach in that, and ha, 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 ha. And that's a cute joke, but that's not really what it was about. Rather, even what is now, because of that controversy, called Ebonics, but which used to be called Black English or African-American Vernacular English, that variety is spoken by people alongside Standard English. So the person who can only conduct themselves in not only the slang, but as we'll see in a later lecture, the grammatical structure and the different even basic words that you sometimes find in the very different sound system of that dialect are rare. That's a child. If you go to a supermarket and there is a black mother with a little kid who's only, you know, 2.5 feet high or however high toddlers are, I don't have one of my own yet, so I don't know. Often, the toddler clearly only speaks black English yet. But that's because he's still bouncing on that knee of his mother. He or she has not been to school yet. But in general, if you are an African American, then if you control black English, then you also control standard English. And as a result, the Ebonics controversy and black English in general reveal all of the issues about diglossia that we've seen in this lecture with Egyptian Arabic and Swiss German, etc. So, for example, black English is not usually written in some fiction, but even then, to have even the narrative parts written in black English is rare. It's thought of as a spoken variety. You might depict people speaking it, but you certainly do not, for example, write a news report in black English except for comedic purposes. Then in terms of acquisition, you don't learn black English at school. You don't need to because you learned it on your mother's knee. For a person who grows up in black English, it's standard English that they get to practice their chops on in school, because that's what's being presented there. Standardization is standard English. There is no official rule book for black English. One could be written, but nobody has particularly bothered, because generally it's thought only among a certain small class of linguists and societal activists that black English is real at all. A great many people, as many of them black as white, tend to labor under the misimpression that it's all just bad grammar. And then there's the prestige issue, which is that very often a person who speaks beautiful, what you might call Ebonics, when asked, will say that they don't, and often they're quite sincere. I remember walking down the street once and watching a a black boy, probably 9, and his mother, I'd put her at, say, 42, and they were having a conversation about his day in standard English, and as time went by, she said in a very warm fashion, so wasn't nobody fighting or nothing, and then she went back into standard English. Most black people do that. I'm quite sure that if one walked up to that woman and put a sheet of paper in front of her and said, would you say wasn't nobody fighting or nothing? She would, of course, say no and probably would mean it. But part of this is because generally there's an ambivalent sense about L varieties. So what Ebonics was about was diglossia in the United States. Because diglossia is not generally known as a term among people other than linguists and anthropologists, it rendered all of that more confusing than it could be. But now, you know more than you did.